Thrilled to be joined today by Jamie Sell and Donna Waters. Donna is the author of Wrong Ride Home, which is a story of Austin Burke being accused of a crime that they're trying to show he didn't commit. And Jamie is his mother. So I want to thank both of you all for coming to True Crime Cast and giving us some of your time. And we're very interested to dig into the story.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Donna, Jamie, whoever wants to go first, I guess just introduce us to the story. What happened, when, you know, just let us know kind of the details we need to know before we can move forward.
So this started in 2017. Sample was a young man from the community that had come up missing. There was a social media blitz saying that he was missing and describing the last time that his family had talked to him. And in this social media blitz, they had my son's, name, and they were saying that he was from the Bristol area, that he had some tattoos, and basically describing him as the last person to see Brandon Sample alive. And so naturally that caused the community to contacting Austin and our family. And so Austin was getting hundreds of friend requests and people messaging him and asking him questions on social media. And of course, me and his younger brother were also getting, barrages of messages and inquiries as well. Donna, do you want to say something?
Well, I got involved in the case after meeting Jamie at a wrongful conviction summit in Michigan. And I wasn't sure what I could do because my first novel was the reason I was at that wrongful conviction summit. My sister was wrongly convicted and I wrote her story also. And I was there promoting Speak the Truth, Justice for Miss America. And when I first saw Jamie, like there was connections immediately. I thought I was going to retire to Ward, Ohio. That was my retirement city.
Which is the town that this case happened in.
Right.
Right.
And so she sent me the transcripts and the police reports. And I kept asking her, where's more? Because it wasn't there. So that's where I came in. I knew within 48 hours of meeting Jamie that I wanted to tell Austin's story, which is what led to the book. And why she didn't write the book, I interviewed her for hours. Hours trying to get every perspective, and it was all the evidence that we found afterwards and still finding.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Somebody out there, all we would have to really do is come up with a reward, and I think somebody would be greedy enough to show the evidence.
Yeah, but then there's like ethical issues, and then courts start questioning and saying that you're paying people for information, and so then that can like look unfavorably for us. It's okay for them to offer rewards to get information to convict somebody, but it's not okay to offer rewards to get somebody to come forward with evidence to undo a wrongful conviction. So it's like a, Right. They have all the power and we have a lot of handicaps, it seems like, when it comes to undoing a wrongful conviction. And so after my son gets accused of this murder and then there's a Pizza Joe's robbery, what was it, 9 days later, that was in another town in Cortland, Ohio. And so then that is where he gets picked up in this apartment across the street from the Pizza Joe's or somewhere near. I don't know if it's exactly across the street, but it's nearby the Pizza Joe's. They were looking for him on a warrant for the murder. And then they tie in this Pizza Joe's robbery. And I'll stop right there because I know you're going to ask more questions. But then he gets charged with both.
Yeah.
And in the same trial. They do both cases in the same trial and it's done and over in 5 days.
Oh, wow.
Okay. How old were these boys at the time that this happened?
So Austin was 18. Your son,
Austin and...
Austin was 18 and Brandon Sample, the victim, was 22. Am I right, Donna? He was 22, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Yes.
Do they always know each other?
No. Well, they knew each other from...
Yeah, he did know him because when Austin was a juvenile, he did get in trouble for a crime. And he was at Indian River Detention Center, and that is where he met Brandon Sample. Brandon Sample, even though he was only a couple years older than him, was for a few months, he was a correction officer there that was on the same pod with Austin, only for a short period of time, but they were friends. And so how Austin got reintroduced to Brandon Sample after he had been released and was back out in the community was Austin was standing outside of a campground that we had all gone to go swimming because they have like the world's largest outdoor swimming pool. It's called Willow Lake. It's in Champion or Warren, Ohio. Anyhow, he was standing outside waiting for a girl that was supposed to be picking him up, and him and this girl in a happen chance missed each other because he walked down the road a little bit, but Brandon Sample drove by with a passenger in his car, saw Austin and shouted out to him, and then pulled into the parking lot to kind of catch up with him in the parking lot and gave my son a ride home. And we only lived 3 miles from there and dropped him off at our residence. So Austin did see Brandon the night before. Brandon was with another gentleman named Josh White, who was in the passenger front seat, and they dropped him off in a 3 mile drive to my house around 8:20-ish p.m. And then Austin never saw him again after that.
So that was the night before. Can you tell us what happened to Brandon? Like, what was the rest of Brandon's story?
Well,
it sounds like he went missing for a while.
Yeah.
So
His father said that he saw Brandon and Josh White at his house at, what, 11 p.m.? And they were putting groceries. Yeah, around 11 p.m. that night, they were putting groceries in the cupboards, and Brandon told his father he was taking Josh White home. Now, at the time, his father didn't know that Josh White lived in Akron, Ohio. He just knew that Brandon said he was taking Josh White home, and he was supposed to work at Kraft Made in the morning. Well, his dad never saw him in the morning, and he never arrived to work at Kraft Made. And so I don't know if it was like 24 hours they had to file a missing persons report, but, you know, he didn't show up to work. He didn't show up to church. And so the family reported him missing. And I believe they found the car in Niles, Ohio, in a bike trail where cars don't belong at 7:26 the next morning. But his body was found 3 days later in North Bloomfield, Ohio, deep in the woods in an area that the locals like to call Hatchet Man Road, dead face down deep, you know, in those woods off of a path that goes into the woods, you know, a driving path. The kids like to go party there. And it's a well-known a party area, even for the Amish out there.
To make sure I have the timeline correct, Brandon drops your son off at home, goes to his house with Josh, seen by Brandon's dad around 11 p.m., says that he's taking Josh home, mm-hmm. and then that's the last time that his family saw him again.
Yep.
Is that correct?
Yep.
Right, but Josh White testified and spoke to the cops afterwards, saying that Brandon dropped him off in Akron at like 12:30. However, his phone records do not corroborate that. Josh White's phone records don't, because they never got Brandon Sample's phone records that we know of.
Well, what they're trying to say is in trial, the prosecutor told the jury that Josh White, and the prosecutor tells the jury this, not Josh White himself, but the prosecutor tells the jury that Josh White calls his little brother to let him in because he didn't have a key, and the little brother lets him in. I obtained Josh White's phone records after the trial. I subpoenaed them, and Josh White didn't make any phone calls after he called his father at like 11:30 that night for, I don't know, some 12 or 16 hours. Am I right, Donna?
Hours. It was 14 hours, and then he was 2 hours away from Akron.
Okay. Were those phone records available to the defense team at the time of trial?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sure that they were, but Austin was locked in the jail on $1 million bond, and he's 18, 19 years old. And yeah. Here I am on the outside with limited funds. I did hire an attorney, but I couldn't afford to bail him out and hire an attorney. And we didn't have money for experts or witnesses. We started out with a public defender because Austin insisted that we just use the public defender. He said, I'm innocent. Don't spend your money. He didn't want to cause like a financial burden on me and Gage because it was just us, you know? And, so that's what we started to do at first, was go with the public defender. But then I started to realize that the public defender wasn't going to adequately be able to defend my son, because he shouted out in the courtroom one day to another family member that if Trumbull County would quit playing games with him, he could defend a case. And I got scared when I heard that. And the woman was asking him why he wasn't returning calls to her son. And so that's when I realized that I was going to need to hire an attorney. And I mean, literally, I had to pull and scrape whatever resources I could together, which meant maxing out all my credit cards just to get an attorney. There wasn't money left over for experts. And we asked for an expert at state's expense, and they denied it to us and never even gave a reason why. They didn't hold an indigency hearing or nothing.
Let's back up just a little bit. Sorry, John. And I want you to talk about when you found out about the arrest. It sounds like you all may have had a heads up that he was a person of interest, but talk about finding out that he had been arrested and charged, and just kind of what that was like for you emotionally and leading up to trial.
So originally, after the social media blitz, they did come to the house and ask questions. And so Austin spoke to them, you know, they left a card, he called them, he spoke to them, and we thought that everything was cleared up and it was done. So we really kind of went about the rest of our lives. I mean, I was busy, I was a traveling nurse, I was going out of town to work to make money to, you know, support the house and everything after my divorce. I still had Gage, who was 15 years old at the time. I had a boyfriend also that was living with us. So, you know, I was busy traveling, working, managing the home and everything else. And so it was kind of like, I still felt bad for the situation and had empathy for it. But once Austin, you know, told them that he didn't see, you know, Brandon again after he got dropped off at the house, we kind of thought that was over. So when he got arrested, I found out through a text message from a friend while I was at work in Erie, Pennsylvania. And I was like in the middle of my shift, and my body kind of went numb. And then I was just tearful for the rest of the shift. And they ended up letting me leave early because I just, I was in shock. And so my friends and everybody found out through the news.
I was trying to read some of the court documents on this case.
So if you, there were federal, find them on PACER. However, I have copies of all of them.
I was going to say, your website is TrumbullCountyIsCorrupt.com. And on that, it talks about that there was no real evidence to convict Austin. And you all have alluded to that before. Talk more about what was actually presented at trial and why you feel, what you feel like was wrong with the narrative that the prosecution pitched.
Well, the first thing I can tell you, and I like me and Donna, we argue about this sometimes, that the girls that were at the Pizza Joe's that were the victims in the robbery, they said it was a mixed race male, both of them, in their statements. My son's white. So that was one of the first blaring, you know, thing, which we find this out in trial. We don't find this out ahead of time. I saw my son physically in the kitchen in the middle of the night of the murder. So I know firsthand that he was not there. However, because I'm his mother, that makes me not credible, I guess, in the eyes of the prosecutor's world. So Donna, I'm going to need you to jump in here because I'm too close to this. And so sometimes I get too wordy and I say things that aren't meaningful to everybody else. So I'm going to let her, from an unbiased point of view, tell you, because it'll be cleaner that way.
Well, I'm most passionate about physical DNA evidence. When you have physical DNA, solid rock, no denying, not one piece of DNA has been offered that Austin committed the murder, committed a robbery.
Well, they had DNA, but it didn't point to Austin. It pointed to a third party unknown male.
No, Jamie, right. I know. But the only piece of DNA that they have is an unknown male suspect on a gun that they claim was used in the robbery. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, that gun was barely talked about. And then the second big blaring thing is, if you look at the videos of the Pizza Joe robbery, I have zoomed them in. I have looked at them 1,000 probably times. I can't find hand tattoos. Austin had prominent hands, and the tattoos were never mentioned by anyone.
Well, she in trial, she said they weren't there.
Right. But, and then the other big piece of physical evidence proving that Austin's innocence, this robbery happened and they found no money on Austin. They found no drugs that he supposedly robbed somebody else for. And when he was booked in, he wasn't wearing the clothing that was seen in the robbery, but none of these witnesses testified that they seen him changing. No one said a long period of time where they didn't know where he was at. Whether they thought he was in the front room or the bedroom, they always knew where he was at. And some of them were allowed to lie on the stand saying they didn't know who Austin really was because Austin used a fake name. He did give a fake name to the cops. He didn't give a fake name to the kids. Right. I guarantee that, because they were Facebook friends.
Yeah, so they knew his real name.
Right. So there's no physical, there's no video evidence that points to him. They don't even describe to the prosecutor, didn't even describe how the robber came across the street. He makes it seem like the first video is of Austin running into the store. But that wasn't even true. You can see in the first timestamp video, the robber coming from across the street. And plus, I think there's other videos. Whether they're people's has them or evidence that even Jamie hasn't seen yet.
The weapon that they retrieved from the apartment, was that a match?
No. So here's the thing. There was no ballistics. There was no bullets found at the scene where the body was found. There was no bullets inside of the body, which is peculiar because they said there was one, maybe two entrance wounds, but no exit wounds, but there's no bullets that were ever recovered. There was no fragments that were recovered. So there was nothing other than speculation about the size of the caliber of the weapon from the coroner's testimony in trial that said that it could be smaller, any gun smaller than a 38. Is that what he said? A 38? Anyway, that, and so what they did is they tried these two cases together to prejudice the robbery case with the murder case to allude that that was the weapon that was used in the murder. So that was the stretch that they went through. Every time they tried to nail down evidence in this case, they came up with nothing. And so they just kept adding and adding and adding stuff to prejudice the case to make you think he was good for it. That's kind of what they did.
It's crazy to me that these charges were not separated, because just because someone may have robbed a pizza place does not also mean the person murdered someone. So
right.
It's almost crazy that these aren't separate trials. But
see, I live in a big town and I know that that would be two different trials. And
that was brought up in appeal.
I mean, in the Yeah, there was a motion filed on it. The defense attorney did try to get them separate.
That's right. And it was brought up in appeals. And for whatever reason, the appeals courts just kept flopping it and flopping it. I mean, even we had appeals that should have overturned that case. The Carpenter argument, because it, you know, they searched and seized his cell site data without a warrant. And Carpenter case, which is a case that was brought up, that was decided in 2019 that it was illegal to search and seize cell data without a warrant. And so we made the motions and preserved that as, you know, we preserved that for later. And then we later bring it up in appeals and they don't even argue it. They don't even say, oh, well, they don't even make an argument for that. They just ignore it. They ignore the fact that we brought up the Carpenter. What they did is timeliness. They said that Austin's federal appeals were 2 days too late, and so that is why they denied his appeals. They completely ignored the new witnesses. They ignored the fact that evidence was hidden in his jail property that showed that the shoes that they implicated him, saying that those were definitely the shoes of the robber. Well, they were missing a shoestring. And the reason they were missing a shoestring is because it was tied on a pair of shorts as a kind of a belt the night before. He went swimming and they were too big for him and they were falling down. So he told me he tied them, you know, in the belt loops, you know, to kind of keep his shorts up. And so they confiscated these shorts in this apartment and put them in the jail property with the shoestring still tied in it, and then enter the shoe missing the shoestring. And so he couldn't have been wearing these high top shoes in a robbery attempt and ran across the street as stealthy as the robber did, missing a whole shoestring out of his shoes. And that was one of the arguments also in trial, other than the fact that he's not a mixed race male. And They and as far as the murder goes, he did have alibis. He and there were text messages that talk about that, Donna, about the text messages that corroborated the alibis, and the police knew, you know, where he'd been for the murder. He was at Cody and Connor Snyder's house, which was a street or two over from us. We lived in a rural area of Ohio. And he went over there frequently to work on these mini bikes that were broken down. And the dad said, you know, if they repaired the bikes, you know, that he could have one of them. And the dad was teaching the boys how to repair the bikes. So he got picked up from our driveway he got dropped off by Brandon Sample about 8:20. And that's corroborated by cell data evidence that he was in our driveway at 8:20. Austin was with his handset. It was also, we had text messages where I think it was Connor Snyder. I can't remember which one it was. It was one of the boys said to come to the end of the road at 9:20 because they were there to pick him up. And so they picked him up.
So
I picked up at 9:20 to go to Cody and Connor's house. And then the police questioned the father, and the father said, yes, he was here until about 3 or 3:30 and he left on foot. And so the father also told me this. I came home from, so me and my boyfriend went to the bar that night because we had been swimming with Austin and my boyfriend's daughters and Gage. And we went to dinner with his mother at 5 o'clock. And then after that, we went home and it had been stressful because one of the daughters was like mad about getting her hair wet because her mom dyed it or something. And so it was a stressful evening. We decided to go to the bar for a little while. And so the two of us went to the bar and we left at closing time. And when I came home, Austin was standing in the kitchen. And so I did not have knowledge that Austin had left to go to Cody and Connor's house, but he was 18 years old, almost 19. So, but all I know is I asked him in the kitchen, I said, why are you still up? And he said he couldn't sleep. And that was kind of the extent of our conversation, you know, that I can recall. And, but I know I physically laid eyes on him that night. And then the next morning, my boyfriend, his daughter had a counseling meeting and the counselors came to your house and during summer vacation, you know, and, she came at 8 in the morning and we went outside on the porch. It was a nice afternoon And I saw Austin's friend, Clinton Ewing, had pulled in. He's got a white car with Lamborghini doors. And Austin and him are black belts. They went to Taekwondo school together. And so they started doing boxing and mixed martial arts. And so Clinton was picking Austin up that morning because Austin didn't have a car or a license. He picked Austin up that morning to go to boxing. And so I physically laid eyes on him at 8 a.m. And then we have a text message that was never shown to the jury from this Ricky Roop's grandmother saying, I've been trying to get a hold of you. Lock the door. Don't let anyone in. And something about Ricky's been up sick all night or something like that. But these Roops somehow come into this story giving evidence, accusing Austin of this murder. And how they said that Austin told them he did it, that he came to their house. So some of them said he was there all night long and kept coming back to the house and said, oh, I just murdered him. I just dropped the car off. And but they all had different stories about, you know, how they come upon this information. But we have a message from Pam, the grandmother, that next morning, because Austin went there to pick up clothes, saying, Ricky's been up all night sick. Don't let anybody in. Well, if Austin was there all night, like these kids said, why is the grandmother telling Austin that Ricky's been up all night sick as if Austin hadn't been there all night? But the prosecution hid that from the jury.
So after Austin was dropped off, it was said that Brandon and the other male drove to Brandon's house, and Brandon's dad actually saw him and they told him they were going to go somewhere else. Did Brandon's dad testify to that in court during this trial?
And in between Austin dropping Austin getting dropped off and Brandon going to his dad's house, they went swimming at some girl's house. And was that in Cortland, Donna?
They went swimming, I believe, one of Brandon's friends, and then they went to the dad's house.
And then they went to Josh's dad's house afterwards, we learned, because Josh left money in his clothes. And so he asked his dad to run the money out to him. So they saw Brandon's dad and Josh.
And did they testify that at some point Austin got back with them and partied or anything?
Josh testified that they never picked Austin up. They never dropped him off at his house, which is bizarre because Austin never met Josh a day in his life. And Josh never met Austin a day in his life before that night. But Josh somehow knew what Austin looked like, where he lived and everything. Now, another thing, a detail that we didn't reveal was that when Austin got picked up by Brandon and they were giving him that short ride home, they were snorting heroin in the front of the car and offered it to Austin. And Austin declined because he doesn't do heroin. But he was trying to keep it lighthearted and didn't want them to, you know, think that he was like freaked out at all. He's like, you know, I smoke a little weed, you know, but he don't mess with that stuff, you know. And so he was forthcoming with this information to the police and to the family that he saw them snorting heroin, both of them. And they just kind of made it look like Austin was lying and that Brandon never did heroin and stuff. And then later on, we find out that everybody knew that Josh and Brandon had a longstanding heroin addiction. So why they needed so bad to make my son look like he was lying, I don't understand. But Josh said that they never picked him up or dropped him off. But the cell site data shows that Austin was dropped off in his driveway when he said he was dropped off. So all of the evidence corroborated everything that Austin said and did not corroborate anything that Joshua said. So it still baffles me how Austin could have an alibi. He can have evidence that supports everything he's telling the police, but yet they're still allowing these people to lie and get on the stand and accuse Austin. It almost seemed like, I mean, it would almost seem to me like they had a vendetta against Austin, or they just wanted to hang somebody. And since these kids were willing to lie, they were just going to let them do it to look like they solved a crime.
Jamie, let me jump in real quick, because what she's saying is yes, Josh White testified that he was never around Austin, all that. But then their other witnesses came on the stand and said he came around 6 o'clock and he had Brandon with him and I didn't know who he was. And their stories didn't match. Any two stories did not match.
Yeah, even the newspaper stories matched. It was a circus.
And so that, in my opinion, is one of the biggest flaws in this whole case, is that they could never provide a timeline for how this murder could have happened.
But
and for that matter, or the robbery. The robbery, Austin had, I believe I calculated, 4 minutes and 52 seconds to make a change without arising. I mean, he literally would have to change from head to toe. And then their witnesses didn't even match the video evidence. Because they had that testified that he saw Austin running out of the Pizza Joe across the street and he took his hoodie off.
Yeah.
Right by the Pizza Joe.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
We have that video.
Yeah, nobody takes that hoodie off.
That video shows clearly. Right. It shows the robber clearly going back across the street where he came from.
So, I'm curious, Brandon's dad specify that Austin was not with with Brandon, right, and Josh, right, when he saw them that night?
He around never 11 heard Austin a day.
I think he said he never heard of Austin.
Yep, work. Never heard of him.
Okay, so that was Brandon's dad.
Yes, Austin was not there with them.
Okay. For me, I'm thinking as a jury. So as a jury, if I'm on the jury, my job is to say that, am I beyond a shadow of a doubt convinced that the prosecution's case laid out is what it is? And there are so many questions.
Well, and then there were issues with the jury, too.
And there's a very short amount of time.
That were brought up in appeal.
Like what?
Well, first of all, one of the jurors was my younger son's driving school instructor. We did not realize that she was on the jury until the very last day when they were going to read the verdict. And Gage said that they spoke at length for like 3 hours about the case. And that driving school instructor's boss had been former roommates with my boyfriend at the time, and they had a huge falling out. And they were no longer friends, which kind of made me second guess having Gage go to that driver's academy. But you know, I think when we questioned, you know, the owner of the driver's academy, he said, you know, we can let bygones be bygones or whatever. But my boyfriend that had the falling out with that owner also was known to this female driving instructor. So that was one leg of the unethical part of her being on the jury, because she lied and said that she didn't know Austin or any of his family. Not only was she Gage's driving school instructor, but she also had a live-in boyfriend who was related to my youngest son's family, his dad's side of the family. And so they had family members in common. And so she absolutely knew who we were, and she lied in voir dire in order to be on the jury. But coincidentally, she was one of the two females that was bawling and sobbing after the jury verdict was read. The jury foreman was a state trooper from Ohio, and many members of the jury were related to law enforcement or the court. There was an old clerk of courts from that courthouse that was on the jury, that was having, you know, that was exchanging candor with the prosecutor. And
there's major problem with the jury.
Many members of that jury belong to the court or to the law enforcement.
So where does this case stand today? Are there any open appeals that you're waiting
on? We lost the last leg in the federal courts. However, they did not argue some of the most important points that we... So basically, the arguments hinged on a affidavit. We had new witnesses that gave testimony or affidavits that the people who accused my son were actually the ones guilty of the crime. They've been bragging all over town. I mean, we had many more people come to us about it, but only there were only some that were willing to write affidavits because of, you know, how scary the situation is, actually. So what happened is these girls came forward and they said that Ricky Roop, who was one of the main accusers of Austin, who said they heard him say he did it, him and his cousin Preston Whitaker were both named as the people who actually committed the murder. And so the prosecutor comes,
Jamie,
comes back with an affidavit from JJC saying that Preston Whitaker was locked up. And go ahead, Donna.
Interesting enough, Ricky Roop actually posted on Facebook how he felt better when that kid's head blew back. And he posted this on a social media. Yeah, on a social media post.
Before the trial.
During the investigation portion. So the police knew that he was out here bragging about the murder. And
then he switches gears and he blames it on Austin. But Austin and him had had a falling out not long before this. And it was a silly, childish falling out. But they were never, like the prosecutor said that they were friends since diapers. But there was a 5-year age gap between them. The reason that we lost the appeals is because the magistrate in the federal court said that Richard Owens, the administrator from the Juvenile Justice Center, made an affidavit that said that Preston Whitaker could not have been the shooter because he was locked up in the Juvenile Justice Center at the time of the murder. Right, Donna? And then I knew that this affidavit was a lie. I just knew it was a lie because we had 5 different witnesses tell us that Preston Whitaker was not locked up at the time. So I tried and tried to brainstorm how I could catch this lie. And I made a public records request for that affidavit from Rich Owens just to see what I would get. And I got a response that said that they could not give me that affidavit because Rich Owens never made an affidavit in his entire life in any case, including Austin T. Burke's case. So Rich Owens didn't write that affidavit. But it was notarized by the prosecutor. And one of the reasons why I knew that this affidavit was bogus was because as soon as I saw that affidavit, when we were still at the stage with the Ohio Supreme Court, I said to the attorney, I said, I want to subpoena the sign out sheets for Preston Whitaker because I knew who had custody of Preston Whitaker and it wasn't his mother. Preston Whitaker's mother did not have custody of him and I know who did. So I wanted the sign out sheets to see for myself when this kid, because I knew he went to JJC, but I also know he was released early. He was supposed to get out the day after, but he got out the Friday before in an administrative hearing. So anyhow, we subpoenaed those sign out sheets and I got a letter back saying that they were going to do an in-camera review of these sign-out sheets, and they never shared them with the defense. And then the judge seals the records so that nobody can ever view them again. So we never got to see. So they got to see the results. They seal them and then make it so nobody else can ever see them. Now, that was shady as hell. And so that was why I was in on, you know, I started zooming in on this because I knew there was something to this. And that's when, you know, so then I went a step further and I sued them in the Ohio Court of Claims for the public records because they denied me the public records. Well, everybody in the state of Ohio, if you're denied public records, you have the right to sue in the Ohio Court of Claims. So I did because I wanted it to be a public record that public record didn't exist. So that's exactly what I got. I got declined because that public record didn't exist. And so we proved that the single piece of evidence they were denying my son's federal appeals on was non-evidence. And they still denied my son's appeals. And they never argued. They never argued evidence that we had that was a fraudulent affidavit.
Have you worked with agency or private like the project or anything like that?
Oh yeah, the Innocence Project. I mean, they said that they're getting back up to speed on his case. I've had many paid attorneys. I've had many paid experts. I've had many paid private investigators. I have just been working. nonstop these last 8 years because I know that my son's innocent. I saw him that night and I know. And then every time somebody comes forward, it's like, it's so obvious. Like, why do I have to keep expending so much money and time? And then my other sons, they're suffering. You know, they've been battling addiction problems ever since then. Like, this has destroyed our family and our lives. And it has had far-reaching consequences. And it's like, why is it so hard for it's so easy for them to convict my son on nothing, just on a whim that these kids said that they heard him say he did it. But then it takes a mountainous effort for us to overturn it. So now we have to basically file for a second and successive post-conviction appeal all the way back in the state court and start all over again with new evidence. And that's what it's going to take for us to get back in the courts to start over.
Is there anything that the public and particularly our listeners can do to help raise awareness for this, to help get the right sets of ears and eyes on it? Somebody they can send a letter to or email or just get involved in the advocacy to raise that awareness?
It would be helpful if people would at least get the book and get the backstory. If anybody knows anything or has any information and can come forward with it. I mean, we have a huge social media presence. I have my personal Facebook. We've got Facebooks for Justice for Austin T. Burke. There's two of them. There's actually a Facebook for the book itself, if they would prefer to go to the book's Facebook page, and they can contact us directly through the messenger links, or they can go to my website, www.trumbullcountyiscorrupt.com. And there's a link on there for them to contact us as well. There's a few different avenues. Purchasing the book and reading the book helps because it share it with other people. There's been libraries that have picked it up. There's even colleges that have used the book in their criminal justice studies because it is such an egregious, it's so egregious what happened in this case.
The book about Austin's case is Wrong Ride Home by Donna Waters. We will put all the links that you mentioned to your social media, to your website, and to the book in the case notes. And hopefully we'll be able to talk again down the line about Austin being set free and justice being done. But for now, we really appreciate your all's time. And please let us know if updates come up and other ways we can help.
All right. Thank you so much.